begin. If you have your workbook, be picking up in our lesson material on page 78. Page 78, that's where we kind of are. I've already kind of covered the top part of that page, and we'll be moving now, transitioning into the last part of that page and going on to try to finish this lesson tonight. That brings us to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11, and that's where we are. Yeah, I really already talked about this slide pretty much, but I'll just say a couple things right here at the end, and then we'll move forward. To begin our class this evening, I'm going to ask Randy to lead us in a word of prayer, and then we'll begin. So as we talked about in chapter 10 for the beginning of this lesson, you know, Daniel was met by a certain man that had a unique appearance, and we were able to, I think, pretty clearly show that this was actually the Son of God. This is a manifestation of the Lord himself presenting to Daniel this vision that he needed to know. And the reason that he needed to know was because he'd been seeking answers to all kinds of things all of his life. Now, he's a very elderly man at this point. This is late in his lifespan, as the whole Babylonian period has finished, and now they're into the Medo-Persian time, and so Daniel's old by this time. And he's terribly burdened by the vision that he's received and the angst that it's brought him. But I want to point out and just make clear to, one more time, that in verse 14 of chapter 10, he states, the man that comes to Daniel states exactly why he's telling Daniel all these things. It is to answer his curiosity. It is for him to record things. But what is in this message is, verse 14, I am come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days. It is to tell Daniel what's going to happen to Israel. Now, we're going to get very involved here in the next chapter 11 with all of the human kingdoms and the empires and the things that are going on. And all of that is signs so that we could know that God is working these things out to manage his people so that he can bring about his promises and keep his covenant. All right, so I want to keep that always in the forefront of our mind, that this is really about Israel. This is about God's view of his people so that he can bring the Christ into the world. These human kingdoms could have done a lot of different things, but it is Israel that has the covenant relationship with God that they are to keep for the purposes of bringing the Savior into the world. All right, and if we're correct that this is a manifestation of the Lord and it is presented as the Son of God, then he's really talking about himself. He's talking about the time when he's going to come into the world, not just in a visionary way with Daniel, but to be revealed to the whole world and save us from our sins. And I think when we give it that context, it's really just a beautiful thing to contemplate, that Daniel got to see the Lord. So many wanted to see come one day. So as we got through chapter 10, Daniel is re-strengthened to receive this message, and chapter 11 begins in verse 1, talking about a continuation of what this man is saying to Daniel. So it's not a stop and start thing. He didn't do that and then leave, and now Daniel's recording something separate. This is a continuation of the speech, and now we get into the specifics. And we talked about in those first two verses how he identified that the man had been working with Darius the Mede at the beginning of the Medo-Persians overthrowing the Babylonians, and that he would be with the next three kings that would rise up until we get to the one who, the fourth king, who would be particularly powerful, particularly rich, and he would have great success. But what did it say at the end of that verse that he would ultimately end up stirring up, maybe even by accident? Greece. were going to bring about the next kingdom. And it was actually going to be the work of the kingdom of the Medo-Persian king that's going to bring about the Grecian king to be stirred up to start his campaign that will actually end up being Medo-Persia's demise. Okay? So that's kind of where we left off on these things. And I just thought it was interesting to note the time frame that when Daniel is receiving these things, the Persian kingdom seems invincible. Cyrus is coming about. Darius the Mede is taking over the Babylonians, the great world power of the day, the head of gold that Daniel had known. They've prospered and they've conquered, taken over Babylon and spread out the kingdom and continue now to move forward. And there's promise of greater conquering to come. But God is already looking past that to the next kingdom that's going to overthrow this great mighty kingdom. And it seemed like each kingdom was building on itself along the way. So each kingdom that comes is stronger and stronger, and although their approach is somewhat different, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. Interestingly enough, this prophecy comes about 200 years before the Medo-Persians fall. And I think I said this Sunday at the tail end of our class that that's the same period of time that Isaiah had prophesied that Cyrus was going to become king and overthrow a kingdom that really wasn't even in power at that time. It was during the Assyrians that Isaiah talked about Cyrus of the Medo-Persians overthrowing the Babylonians who hadn't even developed as a kingdom by that time yet. So, you know, God's way ahead of all of these things. And that's what we're looking at when we get to chapter 11, I think, that we're looking way ahead and God can see in detail what's going to happen. He tells Daniel this and then tells him, wrap it up. You know, hold it because it's for many days. It's a long time to come. And we've heard that a couple of times back in verse 1 and now in verse 14. These are things that are going to come later. All right? So what we're going to read about now, they probably didn't understand and may not have been able to recognize as it went. Maybe a little bit, but not as it went. Most likely, just like we do with history, we kind of look back and go, oh. But, you know, when we're going through it, it's really hard to see what's the most significant things, right? What are the highlights? What are the real breaking points in history at that time? But we look back even just 20 or 30 years and you go, oh, yeah, wow, see how that worked and this worked. And so when they got 200 years down the road, they could see, yes, this was God's plan all along. Now, Daniel has seen the vision of the tower, the statue. He's had visions of the other kingdoms that Michael talked about in chapters 8 and 9, where we know that those were the empires to come, and they're kind of described in quality, I guess. Now we get to chapter 10 and 11, and the Lord begins to expand that picture, but it's the same thing kind of said again. It's just got more detail to it this time. And now we'll be able to hang some facts on it. But I am a firm believer that we can't go through a passage like Daniel chapter 11 and start talking about this king and that king and this significant event and that event if we don't know what chapter 11 said. You do not get caught up in reading what this is supposed to mean before you've read the passage and know what it says, because you're just going to end up taking somebody else's word for it. All right, and so for that purpose and to that goal, what I want to try to do as best I can is go through what it actually says. What is the story that it tells? And then we just about have to go ahead and say just a little bit to hang on to it, because there's some things that are very, very clear, which indicates why other things should be clear once we know secular history more. But I doubt any of us are great super historians on this period, the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire. We think we know it. We've been exposed to a lot of things, but there's a lot of detail we don't know. This is ancient history, okay? So when we go through this, I want to talk about it in just terms of what it says. What is it, the situation, the political situation that it describes? And then we'll talk a little bit more about application as best we can. But we're not going to solve all that tonight. So we finished verses 1 and 2 of chapter 11, and it was about the Medo-Persians being strong and forceful and then stirring up the next king, the king of Greece. So clearly we move into the rule of Greece, the Grecian Empire. We don't really know the names, and it doesn't name Alexander the Great or anybody like that, but we know the effect that those people had. So let's move to verses 3 and 4 of Daniel chapter 11. And we do not have time to read this whole chapter, but I do want to read these two verses, please. So verses 3 and 4. Ethan, do you have that for me? All right, so with these two verses, we learn that there is a mighty king at the beginning of the Grecian Empire. Always keep in mind that these people did not come out of the blue. The Assyrians didn't come out of the blue, the Babylonians didn't, the Medo-Persians didn't. The Medes and the Persians were separate entities even up until that point. These nations, these peoples, have been off sometimes in other places developing for several hundred years. Right? Rome has been brewing now for quite a while before they come on the scene too. So when they come on, it's not like they just change, hey, we're going to change hats and become this new nation and start. This is a movement that has been building for a while, and then they're able to gain strength. The Grecians kind of sat over here in their little city-states. You know, we've mentioned some of them, Marathon and Athens and Sparta and Corinth, and then Macedonia was its own little area up north of that. They're all little city-states, like Israel used to live in the land. You know, they didn't occupy all the land. They lived in cities, walled cities, and those cities kind of became like states, if you will. They were very independent, had their own leadership. They could communicate with one another, but for protection, you lived within those walls and you stayed in your community. Unless you traveled, and then you went to another city and got inside those walls. You didn't just live out in the open. All right, well, that's the way these city-states were too. But as they get stronger and stronger, then they start to develop whole armies. They all come together. They develop a centralized government, not always a great one. But they develop a leadership where they can take all of those resources and move forward. That's what the Medo-Persians did when they hit Greece. You know, they've been expanding and expanding all this time, and then they hit Greece and they stir up the kings, and Greece sees an opportunity. Since they were able to hold off the Medo-Persians, they think, well, we could just move forward and try to take over the Medo-Persians, but maybe it's our time. And the Lord said that actually was going to be the time they would be recognized. You saw on that previous list, there were lots of other Medo-Persian kings that followed. But after Xerxes and Artaxerxes, that period we know in the Bible history, they start to decline. Greece starts to grow until finally in 333 or 331, Greece really takes over, and that's the days of Alexander the Great. A mighty king was going to come when the Medo-Persian Empire was going to change. He would have a strong will. He would create a great dominion among the world. And then after that great king, it was going to be divided into four divisions. And what was not going to happen that would be typical of a king and his kingdom? It's prophesied. Yes, his children don't inherit it. It doesn't remain as one big kingdom, even if it was ruled independently by his children. It goes to other people. It separates. Actually, we find later that the Greek Empire divided into whole different families, a whole different groups of people. And it became very fragmented. And it couldn't expand it as a whole like it had under Alexander. So it most likely, Alexander the Great is the one that is under consideration in verse 3. And then we know that when he died young, the kingdom broke up into four divisions. Now, exactly who some of these kings are and such, you start trying to put it together. But again, I want to spend time this evening from verse 5 on, mostly talking about what does the scripture say? What does it actually describe? So verse 4 was the kingdom broken into four, and we start to make some assumptions, but we are talking about obviously the next empire that comes, and we know in history very clearly it was the Grecian Empire that took over the world. This is the same map you have in your book, so you've got this one to reference. And the Medo-Persians had owned this whole property, and they came over and they attacked Greece. And when they failed at that point, Xerxes went home, kind of with his tail between his legs and a little bit humiliated. But they were able to keep their kingdom for a couple hundred more years until Alexander the Great came and began to push them back and started now to expand his own kingdom. He did all of that he did for the Grecian Empire in 13 years. It's amazing how much ground he traveled and the battles he won. And the Bible talks here about the ones, how swift it was. And that was in the previous lesson, how swift he would go through and do this. Well, it turns out 13 years and he conquered the whole nation. He didn't just claim it. He actually physically went there. But he couldn't make it back home. And on his way back, he died along the way. And then the kingdom took on this huge new flavor, or new design, under these separate four kings and rulers. Michael put this map up last week, and I want to use it again here because once the Grecian Empire opened up, then you saw four men, Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus and Ptolemy took over these four areas, and they really acted and lived independently. It was all a Hellenistic environment. They all had similar goals when it comes to economy and culture, because they were taking that Greek culture out into the world. But they had their own ways, and they wanted to claim things for themselves. So these four breakdowns, which were Macedonia and Greece, right here, Macedonia and Greece, and then Asia Minor, and somewhat Thrace, if you can see that up there, it hints at that a little bit on this map. And then Seleucus had the northern and eastern area, is what they call it in the kingdom, and then Ptolemy took over the southern portion down here, which would have included Egypt and the surrounding countries. In Daniel chapter 7 and verse 6, Daniel chapter 7 and verse 6, we read about the leopard. And what was the specific description of the leopard? Okay. Right. There you go. So four, and the idea is four, right? So this leopard had four. We talked about how it moved fast and it was sleek and quick, and that would have been Alexander's effort, but it was really dominated by having four parts to it. And dominion was given to the beast with the four heads. Very, very similar to what we see that happened to the Greek Empire. And then Daniel chapter 8 and verse 8 described the he-goat with what? Yes. The great horn, and then four came up out of it, and we talked about that. Fits very well with the idea of Alexander being the great horn to get things started, and then it divided into four. So you see that both times, and these are the same prophecies, different images used to show this great empire. And we've already concluded that pretty much. Of these four provinces, it is Ptolemy from the south that initially ruled Canaan or Palestine, that they referred to it as. And then eventually, they're overthrown and reduced down, and the Seleucids take over. And you've probably heard of the Seleucid Empire. Again, that's also from the Greek origin. But then the northern king has dominion over over the Israel and that surrounding area. So let's go to Daniel chapter 11 and pick up in verse 5. And again, I'm not reading this, but I'd like for you to scan it. I know you've already read it, but I'd like for you to scan it as we go. And I'm going to just try to summarize what I got out of the verse. Now, I'm going to give you a chance if you want to change something or think, no, that's not what I got out of it, please do. That's perfectly fine. But that's kind of the view that we want to take of this kingdom. All right. Daniel chapter 11 and beginning of verse 5. So verse 5 talks about the king of the south will be strong and have great dominion. Well, if you're Israelite focused on this, and this is from Israel's perspective, then you're going to see the southern king as being the strong one in this kingdom. Verse 6 says he will make an alignment, or try to make an alignment, with the king of the north, and will even give his daughter to make an alliance. But the alliance isn't going to work. It's going to fail. And ultimately, verse 7 says that her offspring is going to be a challenge to the king of the north. So that's just how the verses read, and that's the effect we're told. Verse 8, the north is going to lose in that when that challenge. Great captives and all of their gods, and where are they going to be taken to? Egypt. So they've moved from the north down to the south. So this capturing, right, of the captives and the gods. And verse 9 says that the king of the south is going to return home with that all that success, and he's going to be satisfied for a while. And then he's going to get stirred up again. And verse 10 through 13 kind of together is one big thought. And it says that the sons of the king of the north are finally going to stir up to go to Egypt. Like, go get our captives back, or go get our gods back, or, you know, this humiliation we don't want to suffer anymore. And the king of the south is going to be terribly angered by them trying to come down there from the north. And the king of the south is going to come out to fight with them with a great multitude. And he's going to take a great multitude and become arrogant about it as he fights with 10,000s as he goes. But the scripture prophesies that he's not going to be stronger for it. It's not really going to enhance his kingdom. He's going to kind of go out and fight, and then it's only so much headway he can make. And then finally, the king of the north eventually is going to return again with a greater army and even more provisions to fight again. And that's going to be an opportunity for the northern kingdom to take some advantage. Verse 14 and 15 then continues how that many will take that opportunity to rebel against the king of the south, and he will begin to lose dominance. And you're going to see a transition to the king of the north. All right, I'm going to pause there just for a moment, and let's go to page 80 in our workbook. And we had a few verses to fill in, and we'll be looking at these verses as we go. So let's do that first, because you had this kind of as your homework, I guess. On page 80, these discover passages. So in this, we have some suggestions on what some of these people may mean or these relationships may be, and we'll take that for what it's worth at the moment from the author. So number one, who has that for me? You can fill in the blanks as you read it. Okay, Daniel 11:16. With a glorious land or the Holy Land with destruction in his hand, and other versions say consumption in his hand. Consuming it, destroying it as he goes, you know, shooting it. I've even had a picture of grasshoppers. You know, they consume and it devastates where they go. All right, number two. This is from Daniel 11:20. Yes, Beth? Okay, go ahead, Beth. Bob, I'll have you do the next one, please. Bob, aren't you glad you didn't end up taking that one after all? But I love the teacher raising her hand over here. Can I go next? And, you know, that's good. All right, the glory of his kingdom. The glory of his kingdom was the fill-in there. All right, number three. Bob, you have that? The covenant. He's going to be set against the holy covenant. I think we probably have a guess at what that might mean, and certainly what it would mean in Bible terms. And finally, number four. We'll do that one and stop there for the moment. Number four. And then the note there that the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, has, for ships of Kittim, it has Romans. And we do know that the ships of Kittim were actually from the island of Cyprus, which was controlled by the Romans, even during this time when Greece was really the dominant area. There was a Roman contingent there. They're not a world power. They're kind of off to the side over there in Italy, but they do own Cyprus and control that place, and these ships had come from that. So you can start to see them exert a little bit, these ships of Kittim. And the Septuagint helps us know specifically that that was the Romans. So that's a direct translation to Greek for us. All right? So let's go back to our text now, verses 16 and 17. After the king of the south loses and he has great defeat there, then the king of the north will be emboldened to expand and will take the glorious land, Israel. So all of this time, Israel has been under the control of the king of the south. And then now it's going to convert as the king of the north becomes stronger and they take that precious land that they love. Now the Bible refers to it as the glorious land, and that thing helps us understand what we're talking about there. It's the Holy Land, the children of Israel's land, even though it's quite different than what it used to be in the past, but it's still that. But it also speaks to how desirable this property still is as the thoroughfare and the connection point between the north and the south. And if you go from one to the other, you pass through this area. So it's still very much in play always between these kingdoms. And the one that got stronger now is able to take that over. That's verses 16 and 17. Now, 18 and 19 goes on to say that the king of the north is going to reach out to obscure locations to conquer. It talks about it being isles. That doesn't necessarily mean islands out in the water. Sometimes it just means far off locations that are maybe isolated or had been isolated, and now they're incorporated. The scriptures talk about it that way too, the isles of this, the isles of that, and the Psalms. And it's not necessarily talking about islands and water. it's distant, isolated places that are now under the umbrella and kind of become more significant that way. It says that the king of the north will plan to return home, but he will be lost away from home. Now, see, again, I don't know the kings, all the individual rulers and generals and kings. I don't know that any of us do enough to name all of this, so I'm not going to try to name that. That's what God said was going to happen during this campaign. So the king of the north rises up. He goes off and he has great conquering and he really expands his own kingdom, but he doesn't really make it back home and he doesn't end up prospering personally from this. So verse 20 then has a new ruler in the north, a new king of the north, and he's going to focus on raising money through taxes. But it must have been a Democrat. But he will die in a short period. He's going to die in a short period. And it's specified he is not in anger or in war. So he doesn't die because somebody tries to assassinate him. And he doesn't die because he got in war and got killed. Isn't that interesting? That kind of detail is in there. It's not an anger or war. He just dies. So he gets sick or something. Or just maybe he was old when he got into office there and he ended up dying. Verse 21. The next person that comes along, how is that man described? Vile. What else? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Yeah. Dishonorable man is being given rule at this point. A vile, dishonorable man. And how is he going to come to power? Flattery. Politician to the heart, right? It kind of implies he doesn't have the power to overcome and take the position. He schmoozes, if you will. Everybody likes that word. You know, the slick salesman, right? And he works in until he is able to get them to give him the throne. So he works his way into it by flattery. I'll say anything. I'll promise anybody anything. I'll kiss all the babies, and they'll make me king. But he's not a desired person for this, and he ends up getting it kind of just strictly out of flattery, manipulation, and he does not have the right to rule. It's not being passed on to him. He takes it, but in a very subtle way. He really doesn't shed any blood or tries not to make too many people unhappy. Verses 22 through 24, he's going to be strong to win every battle. Once he gets into power, then he is able to command the forces of his kingdom. And he's going to be strong in battle. And it's going to include the land of Israel. And he's going to use the strategy that he used before like none of the previous rulers had ever used. So he's got his own way about going about things. And one of those tactics is what? I thought this was interesting. It specifically says that he would use this tactic. What is he going to spread around? So he goes out and he wins battles, and you know most of the time the king or the army will gather all that and hold it, but he kind of wins and he disperses it equally among everybody. So takes from the poor and gives to the rich, or vice versa, or whatever it is. He's spreading it all around. What does that do for him as a king? Hey, go conquer some more. We'd love some more stuff, you know. So, but he's very very much. A slick salesman about things and doesn't try to hoard up the riches for himself, spreads it around, and so he generates all of this kind of goodwill or at least great tolerance and appreciation for what they get out of him. I'm not sure that he was a desirable person because of the way he's described at the beginning, but he certainly wins people over by feeding all of their lusts. All the while, it says, he's planning his strategy in the strongholds of the kingdom. All this time, he's making people feel good. He's distracting them, welfare, and then makes them susceptible to just doing what he wants done. I say these things because, people are trying the same tactics, right? Politicians who are not straightforward and good leaders will try the same kinds of tactics. That's the way you do it. Manipulate the masses that way. Verses 25 through 28. Follow me here as I go through that. 25 through 28. The king of the north will again go against the king of the south. And the king of the south is going to raise a great army to fight. Is he going to be successful? No. He's going to lose, and how bad will it be? It says he will suffer great loss. Great loss. All of the discussions about how to defeat them or how what to do about it, all everything will be lies and strategies until finally the south will fall. Again, Do you know the details of the history here? I don't know it enough in detail to say this is that, this is that, and this is that. So I'm going to take the Lord's description of it, and that's what we're going to take away from this tonight. When the South falls, when this is not successful for the South and the South falls, it's going to embolden the new king of the North. And he will have no reverence for other beliefs, including the beliefs that are taught by Israel, the one true God, and the specialness of the temple that is in Jerusalem, and etc., other things like that. And finally, in verses 29 through 30, he will eventually push south even again, and it will be a very unique campaign, it says. The king of the north will be hindered, though, by the ships of Chittim, that is of Cyprus, and again the Septuagint calls that the Romans, the Roman forces, and they will discourage him at first, and he'll kind of go home and be indignant about things, but then he is going to push back into Israel again, and he's going to have a great hatred and fervor against the Holy Covenant. We read that in those passages just a moment ago. All right? Any thoughts or comments at this point? Think I've missed anything too badly? Just trying to summarize it, basically, what it says. It's an interesting story, even if you can't put names on it. Just watch how it goes. And you see this play out through history all the time. Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely. And once you try to start looking at secular history some, you will be able to do a lot of it. I just don't want you to take my word for it or even that concordance of word for it, that the specific is absolutely right. But what is true and right is that this is how it's all going to play out. And the Lord didn't put specific names on every single thing. But he's done that enough, I think, that we should accept that he is talking about specific people and specific events and specific interactions. And then it does become pretty easy to say, well, I believe it's accurate. I believe that it is what it says is going to be. And so then you start looking through secular history and go, yeah, that's exactly what happened. Right. That's right. That's right. That's right. Yep. So very good. Okay, so that brings us to verses 31 through 35. And there's a little bit of a change here, I think. So verses 31 through 35, with no regard for the covenants of the temple of the God of Israel, this king of the north now who is really turned on Israel particularly, pollutes the temple, takes away the sacrifice, forbids offering anymore, and leaves the temple desolate. No one can go in. No one can use it. They're not to use the temple for the purpose of worshiping God. So there are no daily sacrifices. He takes those away. He takes away the burnt offerings. And therefore, there can be no worship of the Lord in this temple at this time. And some of the Israelites, it says, will fall for his flattery. So he again does it by trying to manipulate Israel. And unfortunately, way too many of the Israelites fall for the flatteries, fall for this tactic that this king uses over and over. But it does say that there are faithful who are going to push back against those restrictions, and they're going to try to help others to overcome that. Unfortunately, many of them will die at the hand of the king and be turned in and called traitors and such while they're attempting to instruct their brethren how not to fall for this and maintain their worship of the Lord. Verses 33 through 35 in particular are probably leading up to and during the Maccabean Revolt and the period of the independence. Because that's what happened when Michael's going to go into a lot more detail about this in the next lesson. I love how these layer on top of each other to do that. So I'm telling you this a little bit here. He's going to fill it in a lot more in the next lesson. that the Maccabees and those under them that led to them creating a revolt for independence strongly encouraged Israelites, don't fall for this. Don't give in to it. Let's keep the temple worship going and let's move forward. They have a really hard time until finally the Hasmonean family comes in and the Maccabees, and they actually are able to pull out from the rule of these kings. They find a weak spot and they're successful to do that. But until that time, there was great death and suffering. As this king of the north tried to cease the worship and the sacrifices at the temple. Now, this is referred to as the abomination of desolation. Go to page 81 in your workbook, please, and we only have a couple of minutes left, so let's do this quickly if you can, please. Would somebody do number 5 for me? Okay, verse 31. Okay, and then number 6. He, Rome, will enter the glorious land, and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand: Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. And then number 7, he will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. And he says here that Rome's rule in Palestine was centered in Caesarea on the coast. All right, so those are passages that are pertinent as we go through this section right here. And let's try to do this a little bit of justice. Let me just say that this abomination of desolation is a term that has been taken out of context to make it something mystical. This is in the same way that Antichrist has been used that way. Armageddon has been used that way out of the Revelation. They're not mystical. This is a straightforward description of what happened. I actually was just talking to my mom fairly recently about this, and she was trying to work something out, and I said, you know, we always put emphasis on the word abomination, right? But and they talk about some sculpture or statue that was moved into the temple and desecrated it. No, it is the abomination that a man would come in and stop the sacrifices of God, to make the temple a desolate place. It is supposed to be a living place. It is where the God of heaven and earth meets his people. It is where they conduct their worship and service to the true living God, the only one out of all these kings that believe all kinds of things in the world. The abomination is that he makes the temple desolate when God commands what's supposed to be done there. It's actually very straightforward. It's just a description. You seem to be agreeing and nodding your head. Yeah. Yes. And that's actually true in a lot of the King James says the same thing, the abomination that maketh desolate. So it is not this mystical thing. It is a description of this man taking power and authority he did not have and causing Israel to sin by leaving the temple desolate, no sacrifices being offered. And that's an abomination before the Lord. After the success of stopping the king of the north, as this other kingdom did with their ships of Kittim, in verse 30. The narrative seems to turn in verse 36, following this period of independence, in verse 36. And it doesn't seem to be describing the same king. So if we did move from the empire through the period of the independence, and now we have a new king on the horizon here, I think it fits very well that this description is different. The king of verse 36 is described differently than the kings of the Greek empires. He's exalted above all. He speaks against the God of heaven. He claims godhood himself, it says. And it says this will continue until the time of God's full indignation. Well, see, it doesn't imply that there are any other breaks. And so it seems like these kings will maintain this assumption of godhood until God destroys their nation. All right, so there would be no new kingdom. So I think we are talking about the last kingdom here, the Roman Empire. Verse 37, it says he will make himself greater than every other person. He won't respond to father or the desire of women or any god. Verse 38, what is his god? What does he worship? Self, is that what you said? Yeah, self. What specifically? It did actually indicate something, or it did to me anyway. Maybe I misread something. He will honor the god of forces. His power is his thing. The ability to control and dominate, that's his god. You know, they may claim gods and they may have pulled things from the Greek religious stuff, but they worship the god of power. And he says he will pour his resources into the military like he's worshiping a god. He has a devotion to being mighty. Verse 39, he will conquer with the strongest hand, rule over many, and organize the lands for optimum gain. And in verse 40, he will have conflict with the king of the south and the king of the north, but this new king will roll into their countries and overflow them like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. So he's going to roll into where these other kings are and just absolutely dominate them and take them over. Well, that's exactly what Rome did. Verse 31, he will invade Israel to conquer it, and he will overthrow many, but Israel, Edom, Moab, and Ammon will all be left intact, even though other nations round about fall, and eventually even Egypt will fall. And that's the conflict with Cleopatra. That's that whole Cleopatra and her brother and all of that that happened. And effectively, he controls the Libyans and the Ethiopians, at least financially, which takes all their force out. And I'm almost there. Verse 44, there'll be a change of focus when new opportunities and problems seem to come out of the east and the north, and it's going to draw him back out of the south. And Israel is going to be left with an occupying force, and they build a tabernacle or a place that's not their headquarters, but a place for them to operate out of. And, of course, it mentions Caesarea was a man-made harbor that Rome built because there wasn't a good harbor there on the plains of Sharon. And so they built that harbor, and then they had access in and out of Jerusalem back and forth between the Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea, which is between the seas that it mentions there. Real quickly, Pompey did conquer Palestine. He was the great general. And after he conquered Palestine, Pompey had a civil war with Julius Caesar for domination and ended up being defeated, and he ran down to Egypt, and there he died. And the movie, Cleopatra, I actually saw it not too long ago, back in 1964, opens with that scene when Julius Caesar goes down to Egypt to basically make sure that Pompey's really dead so that Caesar can take over and be the ruler of Rome without resistance at that point. So it's all well documented. You were not asked to look at this, but Daniel chapter 12 and verse 1 is really the end of this. Somebody else saw it too. 12:1 really is the end of the narrative, and it brings us back to our point. At that time shall Michael stand up. The great prince will stand for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people, Daniel, thy people, he says, shall be delivered, every one that was found written in the book. So after all these terrible things, and what's going to happen to Jerusalem when Rome ends up destroying it and leveling the temple, the faithful still have the promise, and that's what Daniel wanted to hear and needed to share, is that if you are faithful, you'll be in the book of life, and you will rise up and be successful after all. You'll be saved. And that was God's promise to the faithful through all of these things that are going to happen. All right? Thank you for your time tonight. I appreciate it.